Hello, this is Barbara Ridenour with the Decatur Herald and Review, dated April 20th, 2018. We'll start today's reading on the front page with Community Support, Rally, Embrace Your Voice. Take Back the Night Participants Battle Sexual Violence. Decatur. Megan and Braden Hull were among the crowd of about 100 people who decried sexual violence at Thursday's Take Back the Night rally. It was not the first time the Decatur couple has participated in the event, which is annually hosted by the growing Strong Sexual Assault Center with their 3-month-old daughter in tow. The Hull said that they joined the rally at Central Park to show support for both sexual violence survivors and the work that Growing Strong does within the city. "They help people," said Megan Hull. "I went there, so they impacted my life. I appreciate the things that they do for our community." Since the 1970s, Take Back the Night events have grown into an international initiative to protest against sexual violence and violence against women. Growing Strong has been a part of the movement since 1985, according to Executive Director Kathy Byers, and she said the event continues to be an encouraging and empowering experience for those who attend. After releasing teal balloons into the air, participants marched to Central Park from 3 locations: Grace United Methodist Church, the Herald and Review, and Millikan University. On the way to the rally, the marchers carried signs and chanted phrases like, "Stop the violence, no more silence." The theme of Thursday's rally, Embrace Your Voice, coincides with the overall message of Sexual Assault Awareness Month, which is recognized throughout April. This year's remembrance is the first since the nationwide hashtag MeToo movement, triggered by the sexual misconduct scandal involving Hollywood producer Harvey Weinstein and others. The movement encouraged hundreds of people to speak out against experiences with predatory sexual behavior and workplace violence, and sparked a national conversation. Byers said that the theme of embracing one's voice doesn't only apply to survivors of sexual violence, as it can also refer to everyone else. Here in 2018, it's still just a topic that's not talked about, and victims of it are still not believed, Byers said of sexual violence. Year-round, our goal is to raise awareness and bring in community members so that we can start having those conversations. During the rally, Growing Strong counselors shared words of encouragement through poetry, and survivors of sexual violence were given the opportunity to embrace their own voices and share about their experiences. Ample time was dedicated to educating the attendees on the issues of consent and raising awareness of the global threat of human trafficking. A 2017 report by the International Labor Organization and Walk Free Foundation estimated that 40.3 million people are entrapped in modern-day slavery, and 4.8 million of them are in forced sexual exploitation. The issue of human trafficking goes beyond sexual exploitation and also includes forced labor in many different industries in nearly every country and every state across the globe, said Laura Dean, assistant professor of political science at Millikan. Dean and a group of her students spoke about their community-wide efforts to bring attention to human trafficking. Kristen Siders, a sexual assault counselor for Growing Strong, further touched on the community role in combating both sexual violence and behavior that can silence survivors. Instead of using words and actions to blame victims of sexual violence, she said, people should be more willing to hold abusers accountable. I'll tell you what, I don't care how short her skirt is. I don't care if she was drinking, because drinking doesn't cause rape, Siders said. Short skirts don't cause rape, and flirting definitely doesn't cause rape. The only thing that causes rape is a rapist, she said. To Byers, calling out those who commit acts of sexual violence is one of the first steps to fight the issue head-on, and we need to start believing when disclosures are made and not blame the victims. We need to hold offenders accountable through and through. According to the National Sexual Violence Resource Center, 1 in 2 women have experienced sexual violence other than rape in their lifetime. 1 in 5 men have experienced sexual violence other than rape in their lifetime. Fewer than 5% of completed or attempted rapes against college women were reported to law enforcement. 67.5% of instances of rape are estimated to go unreported. Paw Print Ministry dogs were on hand to pet and get rid of stress Thursday at Central Park in Decatur during Take Back the Night events. Crossing gets rest of grant. Comptroller releases $2.25 million to Health Center, Decatur. The Comptroller's office received the go-ahead on Thursday from Republican Governor Bruce Rauner's administration to release the remaining money of a state grant to Crossing Healthcare, originally awarded to the Decatur Clinic 4 years ago. The move came 6 days after the Comptroller's office received a release of $750,000 for Crossing state grant from the Department of Commerce and Economic Opportunity, a quarter of the total $3 million. State Senator Andy Menard, Democrat of Bunker Hill, last week publicly questioned why the money had not yet been released, a sentiment echoed by Democratic State Comptroller Susana Mendoza on Thursday in a telephone interview with the Decatur Herald and Review. The governor's administration said the grant processing followed standard procedure. "I can assure you there's no good reason those vouchers weren't sent to me months ago," Mendoza said. "They could have sent the entire voucher in its totality even sooner." Crossing Healthcare CEO Tanya Andrix said that she expects the federally qualified health clinic to receive the money in a few days and will discuss expanding services with the organization's board of directors next week. "We'll make a decision to add the position, a position, start another program, or add another dietitian. Those decisions will be based on data," Andrix said. The remaining $2.25 million is being processed 2 months after Rauner visited Crossing Healthcare in February to announce that he would release the $3 million grant, and 3 years after his administration froze all state capital grants over budget concerns. A spokesman for the DCE said that the grant-approved process for Crossing and took place between January and March. Most grants are awarded before a project begins. DCEO typically releases 25% of its advance, followed by payments toward the remaining balance as the grant recipient reports costs, said Bob Guff, a spokesman for the state agency run by the governor's office. Crossing finished building a new facility that was meant to be funded with the grant in September 2015. DCEO requested the $750,000 be released from the comptroller's office on April 11th and again on April 13th, Guff said. The agency conducted a final review of the grant and approved the remaining $2.25 million payment to Crossing Healthcare. He said the grant approval process for Crossing included reviewing the clinic's expenses and working through new legislative requirements. A spokesman for the comptroller's office said DCEO sent a voucher for $750,000 on April 13th and another for $2.25 million on Thursday. "I don't know what happened," Menard said. "I believe that because of public pressure, the Rauner administration finally lived up to its commitment. As good stewards of taxpayers' money, we do our due diligence with the grant process," said Rachel Bold, spokeswoman for Rauner. "We've done all we need to do to get the money on its way to Crossing to support the good work they do." Andrix declined to comment on whether Crossing had expected to receive the grant in installments or if the governor's office gave a timeline for the release of the grant when Rauner visited the clinic at 320 Central Avenue on February 2nd. During the visit, officials announced a $3 million gift from Macon County Sheriff Howard Buffett's private foundation. Buffett's donation was meant to match the state funding, officials said at the time. The DCEO awarded the grant to Crossing back in 2014 under Governor Pat Quinn for the construction of the new, larger Crossing facility that opened in September 2015. Half of the $6 million cost was to be paid by the state of Illinois Jobs Now Capital Projects Program, and the rest from loans, donations, and operating revenues. But shortly after taking office, Rauner froze all state capital grants, and the eventual budget impasse left Crossing with a half-built facility, and its board of directors decided to borrow the $3 million expected from the state so that it could move ahead with construction. Andrick said she found out about the release of the state's grants, remaining $2.25 million, from a phone call from Menar. "I am very grateful for the advocacy of Senator Menar and Senator Rose to make this happen," she said, referring to State Senator Chapin Rose, Republican of Mahomet, who could not immediately be reached for comment Thursday afternoon. Before Buffett's donation in December, Crossing's lingering debt forced the clinic's leadership to be extra vigilant about its budget. Joseph Schrote, president of the Crossing Board of Directors and retired orthopedic surgeon, put up his own assets as collateral to make sure that the center could borrow the full amount. "We were, up until December, paying a full $6 million debt," Andrick said. $480,000 a year was going to paying debt rather than health care services. So now all of those dollars we will be able to go to services to people who need it very much. That's where Buffett's donation came in. He told Rauner in December that he would put up $3 million if the state could match the contribution by releasing the $3 million from the initial grant. If it weren't for Sheriff Buffett making a matching $3 million, there wouldn't have been this conversation in the first place, Andrick said. Daycare owner sues over gun ban. Shelbyville woman says rule violates Second Amendment rights. Chicago. A Shelbyville couple and several gun rights groups have filed a federal lawsuit challenging a statewide ban on handguns in home daycares, arguing the prohibition violates the Second Amendment rights of the operators of the business. The suit was filed Monday against the state and the Illinois Department of Children and Family Services, which sets licensing rules for child care facilities. A spokeswoman for the agency declined to comment on pending litigation. Since 2017, Jennifer Miller has operated a licensed daycare out of her house in Shelbyville. She and her husband, Darren Miller, both have firearm owners' identification cards and concealed carry permits, but they were told by a DCFS employee in March and April that they could not keep handguns in their home while operating a licensed daycare, according to the lawsuit. The Millers would possess and carry loaded and functional handguns for self-defense and defense of family, but refrain from doing so because they fear Jennifer's daycare home license being taken away from them by the state, the lawsuit said. Jennifer Miller said owning a handgun is her Second Amendment right, adding that she and her husband have gone through background checks and extensive firearm training. "We're just average law-abiding citizens trying to make our way in the world," she said. Miller said her daycare parents are aware of the guns in the home, and none have protested. "We're rural Illinois, and it's kind of a gun culture here," she said. "Everyone hunts or knows someone who does. It's not like Chicago or someplace where there are so many unlicensed guns. People around here are pretty responsible, and everyone I know that carries a concealed weapon has had the training." She said the guns and the ammunition are stored in locked containers separately in a locked master bedroom that is not part of the licensed facility. The lawsuit, she hopes, will change the law. "Things have actually happened pretty fast in Illinois, and we're in new territory," she said. "It's only been 3 years since we've had a concealed carry law, and yet more and more people are getting the permits. The law needs to keep up." Their attorney, David Siegel, said in his, "This is in line with the Illinois Firearm Concealed Carry Act, which doesn't prevent an operator from having a firearm on the premises if no child under child care at the home is present in the home, or the firearm in the home is stored in a locked container when a child under child care at the home is present in the home." He said Illinois DCFS rules are more restrictive, prohibiting handguns at-home daycares, except when in possession of law enforcement officers or other adults who are required to keep a gun as a condition of their employment. The agency's rules say other types of firearms, such as rifles or shotguns, are allowed as long as they are kept disassembled and in locked storage without ammunition and inaccessible to children, parents, Parents also must be notified that firearms and ammunition are stored at the home. This is not a lawsuit about keeping guns in the toy box or keeping them on the coffee table, said Sigal, who is based in West Suburban Glen Ellen. This is about saying we want to behave safely, but we also want to be able to defend ourselves. What the state rules do is take that ability away. The lawsuit seeks an injunction barring the state and Illinois DCFS from enforcing the handgun restriction and also asks the court to declare the rule unconstitutional. We're talking about people who are among the most vetted people in the state, Scale said. The courts have repeatedly ruled that having a handgun to protect yourself in the event of physical threat against you or your loved ones is a fundamental right. Two of the plaintiffs, the Illinois State Rifle Association and the National Not-for-Profit Second Amendment Foundation, Incorporated, also filed a lawsuit this month in Lake County Circuit Court, fighting an assault weapon ban in North Suburban Deerfield. That case is pending. The village passed an ordinance this month prohibiting the possession, sale, and manufacturing of certain types of assault weapons and large-capacity magazines, giving owners of these firearms a June 13th deadline to get rid of them or face daily fines. We've moved swiftly to challenge this gun ban because it flies in the face of state law, the executive director of the Second Amendment Foundation said in a statement. In September 2017, a toddler at a home daycare in Dearborn, Michigan, accessed a handgun and shot and injured two other children. Authorities said the daycare center was not licensed. On page A3 in state and local news, teen sentenced for threats. Girl gets juvenile detention for online note to Mattoon School. Charleston. A girl who admitted making an online threat against Mattoon High School was sentenced Thursday to the juvenile court equivalent of prison time. Circuit Judge Matt Sullivan accepted the joint recommendation from case attorneys to sentence the teen to the Illinois Department of Juvenile Justice, where she could stay until she reaches age 21. The girl admitted last month to a juvenile court charge of falsely making a terrorist threat. She was accused of making threats of gun violence against the school on the Snapchat social media site on February 22nd when she was 14 years old. The girl appeared in court Thursday in the custody of a juvenile detention facility. After imposing the sentence, Sullivan ordered her returned to that facility until she can be transferred to Juvenile Justice Department custody. Following juvenile court requirements, Sullivan rescheduled a hearing for June 7th to review the girl's progress. The judge explained to the girl that her sentence to the State Department couldn't go past her 21st birthday, but was for an indeterminate amount of time. By setting the review date, I'm not telling you in any way that's the same as when you'll be released, Sullivan told her. State's Attorney Brian Bauer said the agreement in the girl's case included her receiving a record of successfully completing a probation sentence she received on a charge from last year. Assistant Public Defender Matt Hamm represented the girl. When asked about the case after the hearing, Bauer confirmed that the girl used another student's name for the Snapchat account she used to post the threat. He said he didn't file additional charges against the girl in connection with that because he thought the agreed sentence reached was encompassing. The charge to which the girl admitted accused her of threatening to commit or cause to commit a catastrophe, knowing the threat was false. According to what was presented at an earlier hearing in the case, the message the girl posted included a warning for the school to be prepared for round two. That was an apparent reference to the September 20th shooting at the school in which one student was injured. The message also said, "I'm going to kill you all, and you better be scared, and indicated you will never know when the attack would take place. However, authorities indicated early on that the threat wasn't valid and the girl didn't have the means to carry it out. Mattoon police said the girl said that she made the threat because she was bored and wanted to see what kind of reaction the threat would draw from police and the school district. Dana Thomas House among top buildings, Springfield. Buildings inspired by sports, the Illinois prairie, religion, and the skies above were chosen as the top buildings in the state history as part of the ongoing Illinois Top 200 project. The top vote-getters in the public online vote include Chicago's Wrigley Field, a prairie-style Frank Lloyd Wright home in Springfield, the Baha'i House of Worship in Wilmette, and Chicago's soaring Willis Tower. Here's the full top 10 list. Wrigley Field, home of the Chicago Cubs since 1916. This stadium is known for its ivy-covered outfield walls, hand-operated scoreboard, and cozy neighborhood setting. With appearances in movies, plays, and songs, Wrigley has become synonymous with Chicago. Dana Thomas House, designed in 1902, this Springfield landmark is the most complete of Frank Lloyd Wright's early prairie houses. Its 35 rooms and three main levels are filled with Wright-designed furniture, lights, and art glass. Baha'i House of Worship. The Baha'i faith has 9 houses of worship around the world, and oldest of them is a stunning structure in Wilmette. It opened in 1953 after decades of planning and features a dome 138 feet high. Willis Tower. Originally the Sears Tower, this 110-story skyscraper in Chicago was the tallest building in the world for nearly 25 years. More than 1 million people visit its observation deck each year. Roby House. The Frederick C. Roby House in Chicago's Hyde Park was designed by Frank Lloyd Wright and is considered the greatest example of prairie school architecture, with clean horizontal lines that match the flat landscape. The Tribune Tower. Completed in 1925, the Tribune Tower is a landmark in downtown Chicago. The neo-Gothic building, the product of an international competition, is 462 feet high, with buttresses at the top, reminiscent of European cathedrals. John Hancock Center. This 100-story Chicago skyscraper, now going by the name 875 North Michigan Avenue, was the second tallest building in the world when it opened in 1969. The distinctive X bracing on the exterior has helped make the building an architectural icon. Farnsworth House, located along the Fox River in Plano, this steel and glass residence was designed by Ludwig Mies van der Rohe and was soon considered a masterpiece for its open design and the contrast of its sleek, modern lines against its natural surroundings. Jarrett Mansion. This Cahokia mansion was completed around 1810, making it the oldest brick building in Illinois. The owner, Nicholas Jarrett, was a French immigrant who became a successful businessman and wanted a substantial home in the new federal style. Fort de Chartres. Chartres Powder Magazine. The Powder Magazine is considered the oldest building in Illinois, dating back to the 1750s. It was part of a fort the French built around 45 miles south of modern St. Louis to control the Illinois country, the area that supplied vital food to Louisiana. The Illinois Top 200 Project lets Illinoisans vote every 2 weeks on an array of categories. By the state's 200th birthday on December 3rd, voters will have to choose 10 favorites in 20 different categories, the Illinois Top 200. Voting in the next category, Top Historic Sites, is underway at www.illinoistop200.com. Again, that's Illinois-top200.com. Nominees include the Old State Capitol, the Lincoln Home in Springfield, Pullman National Monument in Chicago, Cahokia Mounds in Collinsville, and Route 66. Future categories include authors, musicians, actors, leaders, and unforgettable moments. Everyone is invited to suggest possible nominees in each state category by using the hashtag ILTOP200 on social media. That's hashtag ILTOP200, all one, on social media. The Illinois Top 200 is a joint initiative of the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library and Museum, the State Journal Register, and the Illinois Bicentennial Commission. Macon County inmate faces aggravated battery charge. Affidavit. Corrections officer dragged by hair across the floor. Decatur. A female jail inmate who dragged a female corrections officer across the floor by her hair, ripping out a chunk of it, is now facing a preliminary aggravated battery charge, a sworn affidavit said. The affidavit said the incident happened in the Macon County Jail on Wednesday afternoon. Kikia L. Fullenweider, 42, was later booked on a charge of aggravated battery to a peace officer. Preliminary charges are subject to review by the Macon County State's Attorney's Office. Court records show Fullenweider is being held in the jail awaiting trial on charges she dumped a pot of hot beans over her 80-year-old roommate's head because he would not get off the phone fast enough. Fullenweider has pleaded not guilty to charges that include 3 counts of aggravated battery. Corrections Officer Sergeant Roger Pope, who wrote and signed the affidavit, told the Herald and Review on Thursday that Fullenweider broke jail rules by tearing pages out of magazines and decorating her cell walls with them. She was also trying to hoard jail-issued disposable light cloth underwear and fashioning it into other clothing items. She turned them into a bra and had made a bikini version of the underwear, he said. She was also using them to bind pieces of torn paper together like a book. The female corrections officer had asked Fullenweider to step out of her cell and leave her books, which she refused to do. The sworn statement said Fullenweider then grabbed the officer's hair and held on as long as officers struggled with her. As other officers struggled with her across the floor. The corrections officer's eyeglasses fell from her face, striking the ground, and it was determined that Fullenweider had taken a chunk of hair out of her head, Pope said in an affidavit. In area briefs, MLK crash sends 2 to hospital. 2 people were hospitalized with minor injuries Thursday after a 2-vehicle crash at East Condit Street and North Martin Luther King Jr. Drive, according to the fire department. Lieutenant Anthony Maldonado said first responders were called to the scene, which is in the Wabash Crossing neighborhood, at 2:55 p.m. An Oldsmobile sedan with a driver and a passenger collided with a Volkswagen sedan with no passengers, he said. Maldonado said both the driver and the passenger of the Oldsmobile were transported by ambulance to a local hospital. He could not comment on the extent of their injuries. Fire crews cleared the scene 20 minutes after arriving. Maldonado said Decatur Police Lieutenant Shannon Seal said no further information about the crash was available Thursday afternoon. Manufacturing careers class sign up set. Decatur. Registration will be 9:30 a.m. today, April 20th, and Monday, April 23rd, for the Introduction to Manufacturing Careers class at the Decatur Public Library. Students who complete the class will have basic OSHA training, CPR, and first aid certificates. Call 217-875-8722. That's 875-8722. We'll take a short break now and return with the second half hour of the Decatur Herald and Review, dated April 20th, 2018. This is Barbara Ridenour. Please stay tuned.